Brianna Kurtz, host of Eat Your Words. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today, all the way from the West Coast, Chef John Cox of Sierra Mar at the Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California. Sorry that we don't have plentiful, bountiful produce and seafood awaiting you here right now. It's, you know, a little early in the season for that. You kind of get to live that life all year round.
Michael, thank you so much for having me out here. It's a real pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah.
We do. We're amazed. It's amazing to have all the products that are available in California.
You're a man of New Mexico. You're a man of this very primal cuisine, in a sense. I mean, at least I know it as hatch chilies and cheese and maybe like Navajo fry bread. I mean, it's to the land. What kind of stuff did you eat and, you know, cook with your family when growing up?
That's true. Growing up out just outside of Santa Fe was a huge inspiration for me as a chef. And I started cooking professionally when I was about 14 years old at just a little neighborhood bistro in Los Alamos. So it wasn't really that down and dirty New Mexico cooking, but that was certainly what I was eating on a daily basis. So the red chili, the green chili, it's very close to my heart and something I still love to put into my repertoire at Post Ranch.
Yeah. Do you still get, what is that, the acid reflux? The, you know, does it still burn you like it used to?
Well, I don't know about the acid reflux, yeah. But I love the spice. You know, when you've grown up in New Mexico, it's really hard to find that same level of spice and really any other cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, going out to ethnic restaurants, you know, particularly Southeast Asian, there's always like the tamed down version, and then you have to ask for, no, I want the real, the spicy version. Do you feel that way when you go out for like Mexican or Tex-Mex or, you know, that style of cuisine you're used to?
I think that's true. I actually just got back from a trip to Oaxaca, and I expected the food to be incredibly spicy, but what I found that was just like any good cuisine, it's a balance of spice and acid and sweetness. And that's really, you know, what makes a great meal, I think, is you need it to be interesting and make you want to go back to the plate.
Yeah, I mean, you're a balance of a lot of that, too. I mean, coming from, again, that very primal cooking of New Mexico, you decided, of all things, to go to Montpelier, Vermont for culinary school. I mean, why the Northeast Kingdom?
Wow, you know, I was actually... I've always had a draw to restaurants. Going to Santa Fe and, you know, walking past a restaurant, just hearing the noise and the smells, I knew I wanted to be a chef since I was, you know, 14 or 15. It's really just been an aspiration of mine for a long time. And when I started looking for a culinary school, I checked out the French Culinary Institute. I checked out the CIA, New England Culinary, and they're all amazing schools. They're all fantastic. But for me, it was just the right place and the right time. I went to Montpelier. Early spring, and it was snowing, and it's just this beautiful little New England town. And I said, if I have to spend 2 years really focusing on this craft and learning, what better place to do it than Montpelier? And I have no regrets.
It was fantastic. It's idyllic and everything, but I mean, it's starch heavy. I mean, great grains, but you're not getting, again, that bounty that you have in Big Sur. What kind of foods and what kind of ingredients did you learn about in Vermont that weren't inherently part of your repertoire already?
Well, I'm a master at butternut squash. I can do it any way you want.
Really? Do you have like a sash and a badge about butternut squash mastering?
I think every New England culinary student probably should.
But yeah.
Luckily, I wasn't there during the winter semester. I started there in the spring, was able to leave just before it got too hot, came back for the fall. It was pretty perfect, actually. So,
yeah.
And actually, New England has an amazing bounty of products. And I think you appreciate it even more because they're not always there at your fingertips. So when the apple season starts or when the first greens start in the spring, the wild ramps, it's really an awesome experience to cook up here. I always loved it.
Yeah, so I mean, it is temporal, you know, things are a little fleeting. And then from there, going to Big Sur, again, you're back into this basket of everything. This is, what do they call them? Cornucopias, you know. you have everything at your fingertips. How do you not use everything at once? How do you teach yourself as a chef that restraint?
I think that one of the most important things that I've learned as a chef is that, especially in today's world, you really can get any product that you want anytime, whether you're in New York or in the middle of Texas. You can get any seafood, any vegetable. So something that's really benefited me is setting boundaries for myself. And at Post Ranch, the boundaries are really that 90-mile stretch of coast that makes up Big Sur. We have these 2,000-foot sea cliffs just dropping into this dramatic Pacific Ocean. And it's a very harsh and extreme environment, which is one of the reasons why it's so beautiful. But within that stretch of coast, we have ingredients that you really don't find a lot of other places. The abalone is really one of our most iconic ingredients. And there's dozens of different types of edible seaweed, limpets. But you also have the whole mountain range of ingredients, from acorns to dried summer grasses. Every week there's a different form of inspiration, and staying focused on that, I think, is what really makes the cuisine pure and a reflection of what Post Ranch is at that time.
So you say harsh and extreme, and I'm bringing it to wine because, you know, I've been on those mountains of you know, crazy volcanic soil, and the roots have to work so much harder, but then you get so much more out of it. And I feel like that's part of, you know, the prize of being in Big Sur. Even though there are so many things ripe for the picking, it's finding these other things that, you know, are unexpected or, you know, harder to harness. I mean, you mentioned already abalone, and we'll talk about that in a second, and limpet, which is not like Fred Durst's limp biscuit, even though at first it sounded like some weird mashup of that. But seaweed, you know, how it's kind of there but not often used as much as it could, and it's a regenerative ingredient. Tell me a little bit about your kind of infatuation with that.
I think that's a great point, Michael. A lot of the ingredients in Big Sur require a little bit of coaxing to pull out the best qualities. It's not like going and grabbing an apple out of an orchard. These are wild ingredients that haven't been bred for generations to be culinary ingredients. So seaweed, for example, it's one of our fastest replenishing natural resources. We have a giant kelp forest that goes all the way from Santa Barbara up to Northern California. And kelp's one of the fastest growing organisms in the world. So it's only logical that as we look for more sustainable food sources, we would turn to kelp. Kelp on its own, it has a very almost mucus-like viscosity.
You're making me hungry about it.
It sounds delicious.
Give me some
it?
Of that with some natto and like all the snotty things at the same time.
Yeah, it's super salty. The texture is not really great, so you have to look at what attributes it has. And for me, the two most beneficial things that kelp bring to the table are the glutamates and the salt. So if you use it as an agent in curing, if you press pieces of fish between it, it's going to bring out an incredible texture and boost the flavor of the fish at the same time. If you want to eat it as a vegetable on its own, I found that pickling the kelp or quickly blanching it really takes down the salt and also changes the texture of the plant.
Well, I mean, you say glutamate, and from a scientific, you know, standpoint, I know what that is and what it does. And, you know, it's found in, you know, a lot of Far East fermentations, misos, you know, even trace amounts in soy sauces. So you get that umami out of seaweed. But again, regenerative, you're taking like the tops off, right? You just snip a little bit of the top.
Right. Some kelp in the Monterey Bay grows up to 5 or 6 feet a day. So it's literally impossible to exhaust this resource.
Yeah.
We're so far from that right now. But not a lot of chefs have caught on to using fresh kelp. Most chefs that are using kelp are using the dried Japanese kombu.
Yeah. And I mean, just within that, how much different is fresh kelp to work with than the dried?
You can just, you know, put it in a dehydrator and you pretty much have the same thing as kombu. It's a little bit, the California leaves are a little bit smaller, but what you really have to get past is that texture. When you blanch it or you saute it, it really becomes a totally different ingredient. So I think that's the important thing, is to take these ingredients and really work with them until you find what they want to do. It's the same thing with acorns or a number of ingredients down there on the coast.
I want to talk about that coast again, because it's like almost too picturesque not to have like an image of it. And we can wax poetic and we can describe it, but people can also go to postranchkitchen.blogspot.com to see some of your photography. rainbows, sea otters, which I like how you had the little caveat that those otters are not on the menu, but they're cute as cute can be. But you're literally sitting, what, 1,200 feet high on you know, Highway 1, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. What's it like to wake up and see that?
That's true. I remember the first time that I stepped into the Post Ranch kitchen, and I was right out of culinary school. It was my first job after graduating, and you kind of step down into this hobbit hole of a building that has a green living roof, and you know, at the time, our kitchen wasn't nearly what it was today. It was a lot more, we'll say, rustic. So you walk into the kitchen, and you look out the kitchen pass, and all you see is just blue Pacific Ocean. We're perched at, you know, almost airplane height. It feels like you're flying over the fog or the clouds on some days. You're really just looking at this expansive view of about 90 miles. So it's kind of an out-of-this-world experience.
So if, like, you don't barf driving there along Route 1, you get vertigo by at least standing too close to the edge.
Every day when I walk up to the ridge, we call the ridge the part of the property where the actual hotel is located. And it's this kind of narrow piece of land that looks over the Pacific. And then to our east is the Ventana Wilderness. And you have these 4,000 or 5,000 foot mountains that just shoot up. And no matter how many times I go up to that ridge, it's always different and it's always amazing. And even though I've traveled and worked around the country, I've never experienced something like Post Ranch. It's just really a magical place.
Well, I mean, even just the rooms and suites and private homes on property, I think there are about 40 of these. I mean, they all use natural, sustainable materials, have rugs that are hand-woven by indigenous weavers. I mean, there's this dogma, if not ideology, that kind of encompasses Post Ranch. Do you feel like you had that before getting there, or do you have to live and breathe it there to kind of entertain those values?
I think that living it and breathing it is definitely important. And having spent close to 12 years working with Post Ranch and Passport Resorts, that's really a part of who I am now as a chef. But, you know, I really appreciate all the efforts that Post Ranch has made to become sustainable and really become one of the most iconic green properties. You have to think back that when the Post Ranch was founded over 20 years ago, this wasn't nearly as popular as it is today. So they've really been a front runner on a lot of these green initiatives and sustainable practices.
As you have as a chef. And we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about the amazing aquaculture of Sierra Mara at the Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Amy Mills from 17th Street Barbecue in Southern Illinois, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here again with John Cox of Sierra Mar, of the Post Ranch Inn at Big Sur, California. It's a lot to say in one breath. I just have to take a second. And we're back. Aquaculture, because you are on the coast, and you see some of the most amazing seafood, you know, literally in the world, coming in to your restaurant. But you're not looking too far. That's what's so amazing. It's right there for you. Tell me about the abalone.
So we're right at the doors of the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary. And we're lucky to have a resource which I think very few people have access to. And that's the Monterey Abalone Company. They grow indigenous red abalones from Monterey in a very sustainable way. Literally every aspect of their operation is compliant with these very, very strict standards of the sanctuary. So it's really an above board operation. All the abalones are raised in open water cages. They're fed a indigenous diet of different kelps and algae. So they're a fantastic product. And because you can't legally serve wild abalone, it's really the absolute closest product you can get to that true red abalone flavor.
And I mean, for people that don't know what it is and aren't used to it, because you see abalone maybe sometimes at Chinese restaurants, maybe. But what kind of, you know, flavor and texture does it have?
Sure. So abalone is probably most known for its shells. They're that really iridescent rainbow-colored shell that you see a lot in jewelry.
They're the geode of the sea.
Exactly. But when you look at them from the outside, they really just look like a rock, you know, clenching onto this turbulent coastline. And they're kind of a reddish-brown color on the outside. On the inside, you have this one giant foot, which is the part that you eat. So it takes about 6 years for an abalone to get to the size of the palm of your hand. And that's one of the reasons why they're such a delicate marine resource, and also why it takes so long to grow them in captivity. Six abalones make up about a pound for the smallest size you can get, and that's about $30. So it, even in California, where they're raised, they're still an expensive product, and you really don't see them that much outside the area, other than, like you mentioned, a few Chinese restaurants, where mostly they're dried.
Yeah. Yeah, you see them in the little container, always dried, but you showed me a limpet. And tell me what that is and how it's similar to the abalone.
So a limpet is something we just recently came across. And one other thing that the Monterey Abalone Company does is, what half their business is, they collect marine specimens for aquariums around the world. And this has been an incredible opportunity for me to work with things that I never even knew existed. And limpet's definitely one of those items. It's the one of the closest relatives to abalone. It has kind of it's a similar shape to the abalone, but it has a crazy leathery black skin. It kind of comes up and makes this monster-like eye. It's a very, very strange-looking creature. But when you cook it, you braise the outside of this limpet just very, very low heat. And it has the sweetness and that kind of small salinity that the abalone has, but it takes on this unctuous texture, kind of like braised bacon. It's something unlike anything I've ever had from the ocean. And then the inside, the foot, has a texture very similar to abalone, maybe a little bit more crisp. And it's quite possibly one of the most flavorful shellfish or mollusks I've ever had. During my research of the limpets, one thing I found incredibly interesting was that some of the hemoglobin that's found inside the limpet is one of the most promising cancer research vaccinations. It's a critical component in whatever process they use to make this vaccination. So they're actually raising them inland for this study. And it just reminded me that, you know, beyond just being a source of food, these abalones and even the spot prawns and the algae, they're just such amazing creatures. And to be able to work with those and you know, learn about them, that's an incredible opportunity.
So, I mean, there's depth and thoughtfulness to your food because, you know, you respect and you honor these things. And, you know, especially seeing the effort that goes into raising and catching a lot of this seafood and the phenomenons of things like the squid boats. These squid seasons are very short, but it's quite the event to actually see happening out in the ocean.
The seasons can be quite short. I drive about half an hour each day to get from Monterey, where I live, to Post Ranch Inn, and sometimes at night you'll see 40 or 50 boats lined up in one of these coves off the Big Sur coast, and they'll literally light up 10 or 20 miles. These bright lights bring the squid to the surface where they feed. And one of the things that's really interesting about the squid is that you would just assume that we can go get a bucket and take fresh squid and take it to the restaurant, but it's not really the case. So much squid gets exported to China, where it gets processed and frozen and sent back, that for me to get my hands on 5 or 10 pounds of this fresh, you know, still pulsating squid, that's one of the most incredible ingredients that I can share with my guests, because there's literally no way to get it commercially. You have to know someone or get it, even though there's tens of thousands of pounds getting pulled out every night.
It's bonkers how much kind of native proteins, because I know that happens with eel in the States too. Gets exported, but gets like flash frozen exported, and then comes back on the resale market. And you know, again, you're at this place where you see all these things living and breathing, and they're accessible, but they really aren't all the time.
You're right, and sometimes we're lucky to see them come back in retail form, even frozen. Things like spiny lobsters and Monterey Bay spot prawns, just these amazing seafoods. They're amazing, but they also command some pretty high prices. So unless local chefs are willing to compete with the markets in Asia, they're not going to see those products, because fishing's a business, and if the supply is higher somewhere else, that's where they're going to sell it.
Luckily, there are other great businesses around you that provide other, you know, ingredients, scooch cheese, fogline chickens. I mean, it's not just all seafood there. You have some really amazing ingredients up in the hills and in the surrounding areas.
Right. We tend to put an emphasis on the seafood just because it's such a part of who we are. But I love the products that are coming from the mountains and from Carmel Valley. One of the things that we've really integrated into the cuisine at Post Ranch is acorns. It used to be probably the most prolific food source of the native population down there. But to take these acorns and turn them into a flour you'd want to use, you have to leach them to remove the tannins. It's about a 30-day process, and that doesn't include all the hours of shelling them and grinding them. So by the time you get this beautiful acorn flour, you know, with all the rage of gluten-free, acorn flour should be way more popular than it is right now. It is unbelievably tasty.
I can see the slogan right now: acorns, not just for pigs. But I mean, it's great that you're out there in the wild picking up these acorns and you're foraging for chanterelles, but then also making other products out of them, such as flour. And I also know you make a Big Sur fritikake.
We do. That's actually on our new lunch menu. And the inspiration was, you know, we have all these different seaweeds that we get. We have these what we call bay fruit. And what would it taste like if we took the idea of furikake, which is a Japanese seasoning mix that's often put on rice? It contains lots of different seeds and spices, but we wanted to constrain ourselves to the Big Sur coast. So we use sea salt, we use sea grapes, kelp, bay seeds. There's about 10 different ingredients that go into this blend, and it has the same umami, salty, slightly spicy quality, but it is very distinctly Big Sur, which I think is speaks to a lot of our cuisine.
You know, you say very distinctly Big Sur, yet I have this little packet in front of me. If I flipped it over and it didn't have this funny little Scotch tape kitchen label on it, you know, you would not. Maybe it looks like a giant pack of soy sauce, but it's yuca syrup, which you're natively collecting from the land and turning into something that you were inspired about from trips to Oaxaca. So as much as everything is Big Sur, you have a very global idea of what you want to bring into that kitchen as far as, you know, ideas and techniques. So what is this syrup? What was the impetus behind this?
Well, it really came to me when we were touring these mezcal producers. Really, they're just tiny farms where they take the agave and they put them into these large earthen pits and they roast them for 4 days. And when you pull these agave hearts out after they've been roasting, which we were lucky to be there when they were actually doing this, the farmer handed me a little piece and you taste it. And it's just, it's fibrous, but it's also sweet and smoky. It has that scotch-like quality. And it made me think a little bit about agave syrup, which is a pretty common ingredient. And I wondered, first of all, if you could make a smoked agave syrup, and then taking it one step farther, whether the yucca that we have growing on the arid south coast of Big Sur, which are genetically similar to agave, would make a similar product. And, you know, I did a ton of research. I couldn't find anything about anyone trying to ferment yucca or distill it or make a syrup out of it, which generally is a pretty bad sign because someone's always done it. But I had a cook who brought me in a 60-pound wild yucca, and we smoked it. We roasted it for 3 days. We covered it in water. We reduced it down, and it wasn't looking very promising. We just kept reducing it until all of a sudden it took on this balsamic-like dark golden color. Had a little bit of bitterness, but it also had a very interesting sweetness, smokiness. And by the time we'd fully reduced it, it really was very similar to a balsamic vinegar, but with a smoky agave-like note. So I was pretty happy with it. We'll see what you think.
Yeah, no, it's so cool because, of course, you have all these wonderful fresh ingredients, but you're taking the time to convert these things into other ideas. I know you've lately been playing with beets and the idea of literally Roquefort cheese.
That was a little bit crazy, and I actually haven't actually even served it yet. But the idea was how common it is to pair blue cheese with beets, and it's really a tasty combination. There's a reason why it's done so much. But I wondered what would happen if you actually inoculated a beet with this penicillin Roquefort, which is obviously used in the cheese-making process. So we got it in a little batch. We mixed it up. We cooked the beets with a little bit of salt and vinegar, and then we inoculated them and dry-aged them for about 2 weeks. And sure enough, they grew this crazy blue crust on the outside. And I actually consulted with a couple of biologists who specialize in penicillin and determined that, you know, it's totally safe. Before I went and took a big bite out of one, we sliced it up and we tried it, and it was really interesting. The probably even more interesting than the flavor of the beet was this texture. It was dense from dry aging, but it was really tender. And it had the only way I can describe it growing up in New Mexico is that smell that you get just after it rains for the first time. It's kind of this dusty, sagey aroma, which if you're from the Southwest, you understand, but it's very unique, and I definitely picked it up in the beets. So I was happy with it. I'm not sure that I'm going to pursue it for the menu, but it was definitely an experiment worth pursuing.
Yeah, well, I love that the kitchen is a laboratory for you. But I want to go back to one ingredient, which I kind of neglected to mention in the aquaculture thing, is that you have these images on your website, on your blog spot, of luvar. Luvar fish is a bycatch of tuna and swordfish boats, and I don't think I've ever heard of it, ever seen it, ever tasted it. I mean, how important is it for you to find things like that and bring them into the kitchen and educate people about them?
We're lucky to have a couple of really talented fishermen who go out for us and bring in different products, but fishermen are also really great salesmen. So when this guy called me up and said, "You never see this stuff. It's the best fish in the world. You have to buy it." I was a little bit skeptical. I'd never even heard about it. So I think I was busy at the time, and I said, "Okay, bring me both of them. We'll check it out." And after a little more research, this luvar is it does come along the California coast every once in a while. But the thing that's interesting about it is that you can't really catch it. It's an incredibly delicate fish, even though it's close. They can get to be over 100 pounds, but a hook just won't stay, and they'll bite it. The hook will come right out, and they'll just swim on their way. So you almost never see them caught commercially, and when they do get caught, the fishermen keep them. So we took this fish, a beautiful fish, almost looks a little bit like a mahi-mahi in its kind of silver iridescent way, and cooked a piece off, and it kind of has that sea bass, really flaky, really tender texture, but truly it was one of the best fish I've ever had. And to be a chef, and I've been doing this for, you know, a little over 15 years, to experience something I've never even heard of, that's always an amazing experience. And it happens more often than you'd think in Big Sur.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you've never been to Big Sur, obviously go and have that, you know, nuanced and new experience that John's been talking about. Because I know I'm going soon, and I can't wait to be blown away with, you know, not only your food, but the vista alone. This is a very special place that we have in our country. So definitely check out Sierra Mar at the Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California, and, you know, see what John's working on in the kitchen as his crazy laboratory. Thank you so much for being on, and hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.